Welcome to Design Oracles. We are here to pontificate, evangelize, and educate you on residential interior design and architecture.
I'm Amity Worrell, interior designer of Amity Worrell and Company.
And I'm Diane Kett, architect of DK Studio.
Thanks for being here, Brad Whitman of LBR Homes.
Thank you all for having me again.
So happy to have you. So
it is an honor to be back.
We love having you, obviously.
So I wanted to just remind everybody and our listeners that this season we're talking about materiality and what materials go into the making of these homes that we build and the installations that we create and the everything from kind of the art to the fabrics to the paint to the build out. So today we want to hear a little bit from you about that on that subject.
Sure.
Wherever it leads us. So Diane, I'll let you lead on your questions here.
Yeah, I mean, Brad, I would say you work with the multitude of variety of materials.
Yes.
Right?
Everything from start to finish.
So, yeah, I mean, you've got...
you have your hands on all of it. That's
framing,
a good point.
Plumbing, mm-hmm. wiring, sheetrock, roof... Mm-hmm. All kinds of metals and
right.
I guess I had a question like how do you work with all those different types of materials, but that might be too broad a question.
Yeah, and sort of
I think it's a good start though.
Where do you start?
I guess. So mm-hmm. well, one of the things is our main job is to make sure that we are vetting out trades that are experts within the materials that their job title entails, right? To do that, we have to have a certain level of expertise from a guidance standpoint. We have to be able to guide them towards the materials that we want to use, from whether it's architecturally spec'd, whether it's from a designer, or whether it's us leading the implementation of the design and what materials need to be used for that. And then making sure that those guys have the general awareness and the knowledge to be able to execute what they need to with those materials. So we have to have a particular level of expertise across all of the trades, not just relying on a plumber to know whether he's using a certain type of PEX or a certain type of PVC or what schedule of PVC that needs to be used. We have to know those things as well across every trade, not just what that particular specialty knows. So from a materiality standpoint, we try to do what we can to keep up with new materials, old materials, everything that's tried and true, and make sure that we're specing things that are going to last and not just things that are minimum code standard materials, right? There's a difference in zip sheathing versus Tyvek. Even though Tyvek can be detailed very well and used properly, I think in our climate it doesn't work very well.
What's that metal stuff? Looks like metal. Looks like aluminum.
Alumaflash. Yeah. So that's mm-hmm. that is a adhered. That's a self mm-hmm. Self adhered membrane. It's a zero perm. Mm-hmm. It allows no moisture in or out, no air in or out. That's a great material. It's a hard sale for most projects though because it's pretty expensive. But that's a really really good product for our climate, especially if the folks have the money to use a WRB like that. Generally, they're going to have the money to afford full dehumidification, ERV, the types of mechanical systems that need to be used to control the climate inside the house and make sure you don't have
any. It doesn't breathe.
It does not breathe at all. Mm-hmm. It does not breathe at all. So if you put that on a house and you use a standard, say, a 16 SEER or 20 SEER forced air system and no ERV and just kind of standard builder grade mechanical systems, you risk a lot of damage. So there's a lot more that goes into.
Yeah, you need all those air exchanges happening mm-hmm. like 20 times an hour.
For
right.
sure.
And so that's one of the things to keep in mind too is and which it's funny because a lot of the trades don't know that. A lot of the guys that even specialize in installing that stuff don't understand why they're actually installing it. They may install it well, but they don't understand the ins and outs of what happens with the rest of the structure from an engineering standpoint, from a building science standpoint. And so that's where our expertise has to come in to be able to guide those guys into why they're installing it a certain way, why laps have to be shingled properly, why things, you know, especially pressure applied tapes and stuff like that. That was one of the biggest things when Zip System originally came out. The guys would tape the seams, but they wouldn't roll them. And you'd have these massive failures at these joints and water actually leaking in and mold issues and stuff like that until you go in and you show the guys like, hey, take this roller, roll this tape, and then give it 24 hours, and then come back and try to pull this tape off that hasn't been rolled, and then this tape that has been rolled. And then from there, once we showed guys that, every time we'd be installing it, you'd see somebody running down with a zip roller.
So it's so interesting that you bring that up, because it's so true that giving a little bit of education about why they're doing the things the way they're doing them, or why this material is different and what its effect is going to have, will totally help them understand.
Just the effect of their technique.
Yeah.
Right. And you teach them that, and it clicks and carves these neural pathways, and they realize they're actually doing something a little bit better, and it doesn't take a whole lot of time to get better. So
you mentioned that, and one of the questions Diane had written out was talking about how the different materials affect the pricing on the build.
Yes, they do.
And so talk to us a little bit about what you end up educating clients and architects and interior designers about early on in that.
Well, we generally start off with the simple term of pay a little bit more and save a lot more later. You know, spend a little bit more now and save more later. It's hard sometimes because everybody's got a budget. It's gotten to the point, though, especially with material prices and fluctuations over the past couple of years, it's gotten to the point where we've had to start turning down projects that don't have the budgets to invest into the major infrastructure of the home. Right, less expensive materials doesn't always mean that they're worse. It's picking the quality of the material, but also maintaining the installation techniques to make sure that they have the value that they need. But we have to educate the folks on the difference in that value from a client standpoint. It's not hard at the end of the day picking materials. Most of the time they're going to be decided on by an architect from what we need to source, but we still want to guide which way those need to go.
Do you find that there's a lot of good back and forth early on?
Generally, educating? Yeah, generally speaking.
Because I always want to know, like I always approach something with, tell me what you know and what I need to know about what I'm specifying.
Yeah, because we specify it or say we want this and then you have to go get it.
Right. Well, I have to warranty it.
And yeah.
Right. I have to warranty it. And so it really comes down to what the details are. And if that detailing is cost prohibitive or if it's something that maybe doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so I think it really comes down to us on the design and build side to educate the client, but make sure that we're all cohesively involved in understanding the details and making sure that our interpretation of your plans is able to be achieved with that material spec.
Right.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a lot to carry burden on. We think it looks so cool, and then you're like, okay, how am I going to make this happen?
Right. That's the fun part for me, though, is playing with the whys and the whats, not just showing the plans to the trade and saying, hey, make it work. You know, if I can't think, I don't want to do it.
The other thing is sometimes, and I know Amity and I try to do this, is if we're specifying something that we know is a long lead time, to let you know that ahead of time so that, you know, like a certain tile, although these days a lot of that's been thrown out, but usually we'll have like a certain tile we know is going to take much longer. We try to let you know that so that, you know, you're not ordering it at your usual time and then we can't get it or all that kind of stuff.
Recently on a project we were all working on, we had lead time issues that caused us to make some changes. Mm-hmm. I say us. It caused Brad to make some changes in the way that he was approaching the build.
Yeah.
Getting a space conditioned to a point that it could be closed up and dried in so that
we maintain progress.
Yeah, we could maintain progress. So I think that crosses over into like the understanding of materials and how they live and breathe and work and what their tolerances are.
Absolutely.
That kind of thing, which is super fun and I love it. But that's what we love about you, Brad, is that knowledge.
Yeah, and that's one of the fun parts of materiality within the build is understanding dissimilar materials and how they come together and how they're going to be junctioned and how they're going to transition in certain spaces and what we can do to promote no warranty issues in those transitional locations, right? So understanding those materials more and being able to design for the understanding of dissimilar materials gives us the ability to not have to come back later and punch things out, especially like a pier and beam house that is going to move. It's going to have incremental movement. Maybe it's not going to be a lot, depending on what goes into the foundation and the structure, but it's going to move regardless. And so making sure that we pay attention particular joints and where those joints are and stuff like that makes a big difference.
So it's interesting, too, to think about that what you do that's behind the walls or whatever, however term we want to put that, that's hidden in the end, that isn't the final finished material that goes on top, mm-hmm. has to be done to a level that holds up so that the final finished material, say, for instance, a wallpaper,
right.
Can go on smoothly, last, not get damaged by mildew or... What's the word?
Mold or mildew. I like mild or mildew.
One of those. Right. All of the above. That can kind of, you know, so what you're doing is protecting those final finishes in a way that...
Yeah, knowing about what those finishes are earlier on always helps, right? And not always will you have a full design plan until later on in the project or maybe by the time we're getting to drywall or something like that. And so we'll ask questions early just to be able to know. And start thinking about those things. Because if we're going to have a crazy sequenced wallpaper, right, we don't have the room for rough framing. We've got finished framing, right? You don't have eighth-inch gaps at your top plate to some of your studs. Like, those things have to be looked at when a wall gets ran out and if framing has to be replaced. Those are tolerances that aren't acceptable. Because once you have that incremental movement will make a difference later on as things expand and contract and move around. And so it has to be almost a finished carpentry level of framing to make sure that things are tight and that they're going to all move in sequence and not have any issues.
It's just another reason for all of the early planning that we do all the way through to finishes mm-hmm. and lighting and, you know, what's going to be on the floor, what's the final tile, so that we can price that accordingly. And so we don't end up, because I do know sometimes we'll make sure we come to, you know, the architect or the builder to say, hey, we have an idea about doing this different finish out, or maybe I want to put mirror up on the wall or whatever it is.
Or cork.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Before I get too far down a rabbit hole with that, like, what does that mean for how the room is already framed out or built? Or what connecting conditions do I need to think about? What are the corners like, the drop?
Or just the wall flatness, like the difference in using certain types of studs in framing. So if we know we want to have a mirror wall, that whole wall is getting framed in LSLs or finger jointed studs because they're straighter versus standard dimensional lumber where it's going to warp and it's going to move as things dry out, right? And knowing those things earlier on also gives us the ability to understand where we're going to be from a budgetary perspective on the labor side of things. If we have to run that level of framing detail, we know that maybe this house is going to be $12 to $15 a square foot for framing labor versus 10 because it's not as simple. And we've got things that we need to pay more attention to, and it's going to take these guys longer to execute these details. So it helps us to obtain a more solid budget early on instead of having to come back and have those hard change order conversations and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's good. That's why we
So you mentioned the finger jointed studs. I thought I was going to bring them up and say, so exactly what are those and tell us about them? And
well, they're multiple pieces of dimensional lumber glued together. Right. And there's different types of glue. That's a whole nother rabbit hole. sorry.
Again, that's another material, right?
It is. They early 1900s, they started being used because it's easier to use cutoff. They get glued together with little triangles, long acute triangles that get wedged together and glued together. They're typically straighter. You don't have the warpage and the movement like you do in a longer piece of dimensional lumber. A lot of the times they're only going to be rated for certain parts of an application. Like, you're not going to use them on sole plates and stuff like that. One of the great things that has come out in the recent years to replace that are LSL studs. Mm-hmm. It's basically like an LVL or a...
So it's like a laminated stud. Mm-hmm. What's the other
laminated L? Strand lumber strand is what lumber. It is. Okay. Yep. And so it's basically like it's an LSL beam or an OSB beam. They're engineered lumber. They're straight as straight gets. They don't warp. They don't move. Tensile strength's higher. Shear strength's much higher. So we've started using those on these wall runouts where we want things to be straighter. Hmm. The problems that we've seen in the past is glue failure from finger jointed studs. you have seen glue failure in the past. You ever open up like walls from the 1950s on remodels and you see all these old finger jointed studs, and a lot of them are split and things are coming apart and stuff after 50, 60 years. So those have been, they still get used a lot, I think, up north. I'm not totally sure on construction techniques in the northern regions, but they're still sold. Now they're sold. They're significantly less expensive. They used to be 2 to 3 foot pieces of lumber, and now they've gotten shorter and shorter over time. That make that lumber up. You see them a lot on builder grade homes, spec homes, stuff like that, because the cost of the lumber is cheaper. So we don't use them. If we've got flat wall runouts, we will always spec either like a structural select Doug fir, make sure that it's kiln dried, and then or a LSL. So.
Okay. I was also going to want to talk a little bit about masonry.
Okay.
Where there's bricks and mortar, and then there's all the stone. And so a lot of times we end up doing mock-ups on site, especially with stone, to get the right layup.
Yes.
So there's the size of the stone.
The size of the grout joints, the mortar joints.
And then the color.
The color of the mortar, the color of the stone, the type of mortar joint, if it's going to be inset, if it's going to be dry stacked, if it's going to be a smear. There's all sorts of different
and I also find that, it's kind of hard with clients because they have something in their head and they can't quite explain, even though they might show you a bunch of pictures. And so we go through so many mock-ups of stone walls to try and get there. So I always want to start it very early on.
Yeah, we'll generally do 3 or 4 at a time.
Yeah, I've done more than that sometimes.
I haven't. I try not to get up to that many. Then we have to start charging for mock-ups.
Sometimes people, all of a sudden, they realize, oh, you know what? I just don't like the color of that stone. And that's what the whole problem is.
Yeah.
So, and then, yeah, so talk to us about bricks. I actually really love bricks. Everyone's painting them, but I feel like, do you think it's kind of going away, the painting bricks?
I'm doing all that I can to make it go away.
I don't know. We haven't painted brick in a while. I painted my house, my old red brick house in Georgetown a couple of years ago. And I think that was the last one that we painted any brick on.
I like got some amazing brick on this one house.
I like painted brick if it's done well. Oftentimes it isn't done well.
Yeah, most of the time somebody just uses like an acrylic latex and sprays it and it starts failing after a couple of years. So if you don't pressure wash it and do an acid bath and do a block primer and, you know, what we if we're painting brick, we typically try to promote using like an elastomeric paint, so it almost helps to seal things out, and then you just make sure that you have your weep holes, they stay open,
so it doesn't need to, the actual bricks don't need to breathe themselves,
not necessarily, as not long really. As the backside of the brick's able to stay dry and you have a path for the water and the air to move through it, then they're fine. The more sealed the outside of the brick is, as long as there's an air path behind it, the more sealed the outside is, the less moisture intrusion that you're going to have on the brick.
Because I read different things. I've been doing some research on that, and I read different things. So interesting to know.
You want anything that's porous to be able to breathe. I say breathe. You want anything that's porous to be able to dry. You want you want it to have airflow. But the more that you can do to eliminate moisture intrusion and wicking from where it happens, the better off it's going to be. So, but you don't always know, like if you're, so that's one of the issues. If you're painting existing brick, you don't know how that brick was installed. You don't know if the back of that wall has 4 feet of mortar built up into it from sloppy masons and none of those weep holes after actually work. So one of the best things that you can do is inspect those weep holes, take a little Milwaukee inspection camera and stick it in there and look around, look behind the brick and make sure that that air path is open. If it's not, don't paint it. You know, you can go in and use a, one of those little stain sponges and stain the brick if you want to change the color of the brick. There's certain types of stain that you can use, a masonry stain, and stain the brick and keep the mortar the same color. It's labor intensive as hell, but it's, you know, that's something that you can do to change the color of the brick without actually painting it and messing with the porosity of it.
I had never heard of that. It's interesting.
And then sometimes if you, when you paint it, it then can show all the bad masonry that happens.
You can see a lot of the imperfections.
Otherwise, it kind of goes away when it's just the brick color.
Right. Depending on the brick. Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot. I mean, there's thousands of different brick types now versus the the red brick and the just the general clay brick that there used to be. And King, Queen, Roman, all the different sizes. The, like I said earlier, the techniques for installation, once you get into masonry and like cut stone. Dry stacking is probably my favorite.
It is.
I love the way that it looks.
It looks so good.
I love a good, clean cut, smooth faced looter on a dry stack. I think it's the prettiest installation, but it has to be perfect. There's no room for error on it.
None.
So nope, not at all. So, and it's cool too, because over the past few years, there's been a lot of new products that have come out to really help. To really help the installation techniques and help the installers from a warranty perspective, and not to get into like saying, you know, promoting companies and stuff, but Mortarnet's got this awesome product out that creates this weepage. It's almost a fail safe, and it's this mesh backer that runs behind it, and it's integrated into a flashing that goes on the brick ledge and runs out underneath it, and it makes sure that mortar is not able to get down in those weep holes. So it's not totally
unreasonable. So you put that
unreasonable.
On, that's one of the first things you put on?
It is the first thing that you put on. Yeah, so once you're sheathing and everything's done, you install this Mortarnet, this product. It gets sealed back to the wall. It has a little hem bar that goes on the top of it, and that gets sealed up as well. And they've got different products within that, from copper to just an EPM membrane and stuff like that. But it's the mesh backer integrated into that flashing that does a really great job at making sure that you don't have any moisture wicking from your foundation to your sole plate connection, and water getting trapped and mortar getting trapped down at the bottom of the weep holes. So there's stuff like that has come out that's made things a lot better, a lot more reliable for masonry installations, as long as they're detailed properly. So.
Interesting. I didn't even know that was a thing you had to watch for.
You know, it's like a pet peeve of mine. If you see the exposed foundation and they didn't bring the brick coursing or stone coursing all the way down to the ground. But then some builders tell me, well, I'm not going to do that because then it will wick the moisture up.
No, you just move your weep holes higher. Yeah. So you do a full mortar back behind those bricks. And we've got a couple projects like that going on right now,
which
where it's spec'd that way.
Back in my old days in commercial.
Yeah, you drop the brick ledge down to either at grade or right below grade, and then you run a full mortar backing behind it so it doesn't allow any sort of cavitation. And then on top of that next course, it's going to be 6-8 inches above grade, you start your air path and your weep holes. Yep.
And then lick and stick brick and stone, I can't stand.
Explain lick and stick.
Like it's just...
You mean like the thin brick, the veneer?
Yeah, it's only a tiny veneer and you just stick it on.
Yeah.
I always say to people, do you want your house to look like the fried chicken restaurant down the street?
That stuff has its place. It's maybe fireplaces or something inside.
Yeah, interior.
If you want a brick-looking backsplash, go with a thin brick or something like that so you don't have to detail everything out 3 inches from the wall. But that's, you know... I wouldn't necessarily say that's not something that you want to use on the outside. You have to have multiple layers to achieve that, because once that goes up, there's
such a purist. I just can't.
There's no coming down. Uh-huh. Yeah. It adds too many different layers to the exterior of a house. It's like putting tile up on the outside of a house, and that has to be detailed more than stucco or it's going to fail.
Yeah.
So,
Let's see. Wood beams. Oh, this is another one. Amity, you probably love talking about that.
So
I have a project right now where it took 10 guys to carry this old wood beam. It's about 22 pounds of linear foot. And we're going to hang it in the ceiling.
Okay.
Is it an old beam?
Yes.
That came out of?
Like a barn.
Where
something like that. I don't remember where they came from.
I love that.
It has all this character.
Is it just being used decoratively, or is it integrated structure?
Completely decoratively. Okay. I mean, I don't know any wood beams that are actually do any work these days.
Some of them do.
Some, yeah.
It just depends on how it's engineered, but they have to be inspected and engineered.
So yeah, we've been figuring out how we're hanging that and not having.
I'll be very interested to hear how that lands, or not. I shouldn't say it that way. Lands. It's not going to fall where you land with how.
And then we have mount it. Turning it over to look at each of the sides as to which side we want to see,
right.
And one side is planed. And
is it is the beam? Is it hand hewn? And oh, that's going to be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of character.
Yeah. Is it a ridge beam?
No. It's just in a flat ceiling. We have four of them.
Oh, okay.
And it was funny because as we're talking through it so much on the job site, the client says, okay, let me just ask, is this worth it? And we all go, yes, it's worth it.
Wait till it's ugly till it's pretty.
Yeah.
So what about beams?
So let's see.
I have a question about them. So I'm working on a project right now where I think, and I pretended to know what was happening when we were talking about it.
Fake it till you make it, Amity.
But, well, okay. So I think we're going to end up with a condition where we can take out the columns that are in the space without a problem, the engineer said. But there will be kind of a beam that's already there that runs left to right across the house that's kind of supporting everything. And I think we're going to want to, like, open up the ceiling and see what that looks like and how far it's going to come down because there's two different ceiling heights in there.
Okay.
And then maybe clad it to make it pretend to be like that, this
that's
real
usually
beam.
That's what we do.
Yeah, that's the most common option. It's not something that generally gets engineered. And there's a bunch of different companies now that are making these hand-hewn looking coverings and or smooth or whatever, and you can order them to certain sizes and they look really good. Some of them are even like foam molds.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really get my head around that. But I think that
it's lightweight.
It is very, very lightweight. It's easy to install. But, you know, if you've got kids and they're running through the house with a hockey stick or something, they hit it, it's done.
That's true. So. I think that the big thing for me what I bring it up for is because I'm thinking about how if you weren't to do that, how do you finish that? Maybe just paint it and try to make it go away and then add something else on the ceiling in another area. I'm getting into design now. No. But, you know, I guess my point I'm making here is knowing all of these things about how things are built and why they're built the way they're built, and maybe even, you know, depending on the types of houses, helps you make the design decisions that come off of those, you know, things, discoveries that you make. Like there are certain types of houses that maybe even someone who doesn't really know that much about design wouldn't walk, you know, he wouldn't walk into maybe a very, you know, late mid-century ranch style house and expect there to be farm beams, you know, reclaimed farm beams running across the wall. And it's that disjointed kind of not connected thing that I think is interesting about materials. You can do it because you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I mean, not really, but, you know, within reason.
Right.
But should you?
Right.
And thinking about making sure that the space, in my mind, good design feels integrated into the person's life and makes sense with the style of the home. A lot of times we're working on, or I at least work on a lot on renovations and additions versus brand all new builds. And so I just think that's kind of interesting how materials will lead to and discoveries. Like before, I worked on a project where we opened up the walls and we wanted to save all of the underpinning, what would have been the ship lab.
Yeah.
And reclaim that. And that led to a whole different design direction in the house. So that's another aspect of
We've never done a project like that. I've seen a lot of stuff where people have opened up some of the older homes and found all the shiplap, and that seems very interesting. Mm-hmm. Be a lot of fun running through and kind of hand sanding and planing everything and making sure you get all the nails out of it so you don't tear up your planer blades.
There's no money saving in that, though, by the way.
No,
not at all. Not at all. No.
It's still fun to do.
Yeah, the more you make people think, the more they charge. So
yes, that's true. True. I love it.
One of the big things, the crazy thing to think about for a lot of folks is, you know, these old reclaimed white oak beams that are 200 years old, you got to think about what they held up. They were 30, 40 foot spans on a barn that sat out in a field where you had crazy high winds and storms and the straightest lumber you're going to get.
Oh, interesting.
You know, there's no reason that they can't be engineered into some of these light little roof loads that are being used now on some of these homes. So they've got their place for the old reclaimed wood, and they can be hand planed and made pretty, but that's some of the most beautiful lumber that you're going to find anywhere. So watching some of the barns, you know, just across the Midwest of the country get torn down and being able to reclaim some of that wood, it does cost a lot more money. It's got a lot more value to it now.
I hadn't thought about that aspect of it,
but it's cool stuff. So, but there are a lot of different options now for wrapping beams and showcasing different sort of columns and stuff like that now.
And then you definitely, you know, even with wrapping them, I mean, we just had a house where we were wrapping the beams and how that end meets at the where the wall and the ceiling are, because we were going from a taller to a lower space. And then you could see the difference, basically, of how they didn't get it plumb, the wall or the ceiling it was.
That's a sequencing thing.
It's like,
sequencing, right.
That's a sequencing thing.
I mean, you've
got to
really think through all that, right?
Well, you generally want to run the material to rough framing. So if there's sheetrock around it, you're not trimming out to drywall. You're trimming drywall to the material, to whatever that beam wrap is. So you want to cut the drywall out. Go through the minor expense of cutting the drywall out, protect the beam, float back to the beam.
That's what we're doing on those big, giant beams.
Yeah.
Cutting out the sheetrock and going back, because it's got so – it's not straight.
Right, right.
But this is a new house and new faux beams, and that we didn't get old reclaimed.
They went up with the trim package.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's just more that you have to think about with the materials you use, right? Mm-hmm. And like you said, the sequencing.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're wrapping.
Know where you're going and how to get there.
If you want that beam look, but you're wrapping in S4S lumber, you can afford to just have a good carpenter that can cope to the ceiling and to the wall transition.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, even on new structures, those beams go up during MEP stage after everything is done, right before we sheetrock. Once insulation is completed, those will go up and then they get covered and protected, and then drywall starts just so that transition is always perfect. Mm-hmm. So
what about drywall when you're ordering drywall? Is there anything specific to that?
That depends on client needs.
Better or
yeah, I mean, worse? It depends on client needs. There's different types of drywall for different areas of the house. There's mold and mildew resistant drywall in bathrooms, Duroc, other things for tile areas. Sometimes drywall guys will supply the tile backer and install that. Typically, we don't have our guys do that. We have our tile installers actually set Hardy or Curdy board or whatever is being spec'd, just so we've got a little bit more of a tolerance to come back and say, hey, this wall's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You did it all the way, right? But there's also sound dampening drywall, two layers, a quarter inch drywall. There's membranes that can go between them, certain types of adhesives and acoustical sealants that go between the joints of the drywall. So there's a lot of different things that can be discussed. We generally don't bring those up in meetings unless that's it's just one of those things that creates complications from an ease of kind of getting through that's something that a client, if they
bring that up later.
Well, no, that's something we let a client bring up. If they know that they want that, then they'll know to say, hey, we want to make sure that this is soundproofed or this is much quieter outside of your standard spec of just sound bats and all the interior walls.
So if I'm doing a music room, which I am right now, that might be something I would want to bring up just for that area of the house.
Exactly.
Maybe where that gentleman can go in and play his music and have his music.
You
want to
talk about the different options for insulation techniques, for different types of drywall, acoustical sealants at the joints, behind the drywall, there's air gaps. And then there's also acoustical wall paneling and stuff that needs to be incorporated into that as well.
So that brings me to one of my favorite subjects about the sound level of a house and the reverberation and how that relates to the finished materials and the underlaid materials.
Yeah.
And so, you know, knowing about that kind of thing, if I said to, you know, maybe I'm very sensitive to sound. And I know a lot of people, I like the house. I like house sounds. I like the way old houses sound.
Sure.
But at the same time, I want peace and quiet.
Right.
And I want those outside noises to go away. Yep. So what
you want
what
the house sounds. You don't want the neighbor sounds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, and when you live in an area where like you don't even, the smells sometimes, even those old houses, you can smell the exhaust and things like that coming in. So thinking that through, and I always try to think of it for finished materials, because I like, but there's a lot more that goes into it, which I hadn't thought about, like the drywall. And,
Standard spec for us from an installation of insulation through finished sheetrock is we run a sound bat in all of our interior walls, whether budget provides for it or not. That's something that's non-negotiable on a VE setup. I'm not going to let you live in a house that we build where you can tap on the wall and hear it three rooms over, right? So that sound bat actually does make a really big difference, and it doesn't cost a lot more. It's, you know, it's very, very negligible. Sheetrock, at the end of the day, one of the biggest things is making sure that it's installed properly. If you've got loose screws or screws that are popping, and it allows that sheetrock to float on that wall, and it's not tight to that framing, you get a lot of reverberation through the drywall to the stud connection. So just making sure from an installation standpoint that the installers have good techniques, and when you're doing your sheetrock inspections, your own personal inspections as a builder, you're pushing on those walls and making sure that you don't see nails popping out and things pulling through and causing things to end up being an issue later on. From there, then it really gets into the conversations that will arise about needing more sound dampening and stuff like that.
Maybe at the roof or under the floors, under the floors.
Yeah, so one of the big things that's also been helpful for us is this inch and an eighth subflooring versus the 5/8 and 3/4 subfloor that used to be used on everything, or even the 3/4 inch tongue and groove old, you know, diagonal pine subfloors, stuff like that. That's been really, really helpful, using the right adhesives on the subfloors, making sure that it's installed properly from the adhesion standpoint is real big. And then on the roof, we use 2 to 3 inches of closed cell spray foam. And then, depending on what the specs for the home are and what the budget is, either another 6 to 8 inches of open cell or rock wool, something like that. That makes a big difference, makes for a really quiet house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quiet houses are nice.
They are.
I like it.
But windows come into play on that too. Mm-hmm. So you got all these houses now have a bunch of big glass and mostly, you know, windows everywhere, and we want all this natural light in these houses, and glass resonates a lot. Yes. So picking the right windows makes a big difference too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I always think of it in terms of, you know, my love of cork, applying that to walls. When I worked in New York City for all those years, we would put cork on the backs of the doors of the kids' rooms, yep, et cetera, so the kids could play video games and be noisy, and we would maybe line the closet doors with it.
Right.
Or the outside of the closet door, so they could pin stuff up and it would be sound.
It's great in offices.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a really great material for that reason too, and then flooring and countertops and all that. So, but that's after everything else is built. This is me just picking things also I think are pretty,
right?
I really like the way that it makes the house sound and feel, and there's a lot of different options. And wallpaper, it's funny to me, people don't realize, but it makes a huge difference if you put a wall covering up on the wall on top of sheetrock. That absorbs sound in a certain way.
And yeah.
It kind of gives you more of a library feel. So anyway, I think it's really interesting too. I have particular things that I like. I like quiet. I like, you know, a lot of texture, but not everybody does. So maybe in those cases, it's something like a plaster on the wall, like a Venetian plaster, where it'll look like not different than a sheetrock, obviously, much more enriched and...
You know, I've never studied the difference in a plaster finish and sound dampening.
I wonder about that, too. I haven't either.
I'm going to look into that.
Can I ask one question just as a selfish thing? So talk to me a little bit about plaster and fire-rated plaster at fireplaces. Because recently I was the discussion about, you know, you see a lot of these, like, Spanish-style homes, mm-hmm. and the plaster goes right up to the firebox. Mm-hmm. Is that allowed? I mean, because I've been told different things.
What masonry do you know that catches on fire?
Material. Yeah.
That's right. So yeah. I was recently told I couldn't do that. I took offense to that.
It depends on what the backing is behind the plaster.
Okay.
So if you've got guys going in and trying to use like a double refined MDF or something to plaster over that versus a cementitious backing and steel framing and stuff like that, it's definitely a big no-no. It's not heat resistant.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know why. I hadn't had that come up before because I've specified it before and it's never been an issue.
One of the things with plaster is you want to consider the material that makes the plaster up, what the aggregate is, what the base of the plaster is, stuff like that, and their heat resistance, right? So it's going to be like taking a torch to concrete. Mm-hmm. That concrete will pop after it gets so hot. It'll expand. It creates pressure inside, and it'll pop, and it can actually explode. Not like a big bomb, but it starts chipping.
Sure.
Plaster can do that. So if you try to plaster an entire fireplace, it's probably not a good idea. But if you want to run it around to the front of that firebox,
that should be fine.
Yeah, you should. We've done that plenty of times. I'm going to
make a call when we're done here and tell them you can do it.
Yeah, we've never had an issue with that. I've done that multiple times. I could be wrong, you know.
Sure.
But I don't think I am.
Yeah. Well, there's a way to figure it out, I guess. It's really what I wanted to know.
Yeah, you plaster it, and if it lights on fire, you
there we go.
Take it out. No, it's, yeah, I think it's just a matter of being cogent of your materials and where they terminate. So.
Cool.
I guess we didn't talk about roofs. I think we have one last.
Yeah, right? let's wrap up with roofs.
Okay.
Tell us about that.
What about?
So we were talking about. We were talking about, well, obviously you got to protect us from the elements here.
Sure.
So, and then the sound dampening qualities and all of that. So.
Yeah.
Well, we've got, so there's clay tile roofs. Have you done a clay tile roof?
I never have. I've ripped a lot of them
metal,
off.
Metal roofs.
Mm-hmm. Clay tile roofs are a little bit tricky, but they sure are beautiful. And of course, the weight of those, you have to make sure you engineer the roof
absolutely
properly for it.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, metal just looks so great. We just did, we're doing a remodel addition on a house, and they just put the metal roof on, and it used to have the asphalt shingle. And of course, metal roofs cost about 30% more, 40% more than an asphalt shingle roof.
No.
What is it?
About 150% more.
Oh. Metal
roofs are ranging between $900 and $1,100 a square, depending on the roofing company and the material.
Well, it was definitely a price on it. Question when they decided, and they were just, after it went on, they're like, this completely changed the house. We absolutely love it. It looks great. Now, yeah, we do have some oil canning over the old parts, old framing.
You're not going to get rid of that even on new framing. Is it smooth or striated?
Smooth, because I don't like striated.
Yeah, I hate striated too. I'd rather deal with oil canning than striations.
That's what I said.
One of the things that our,
by the way,
our roofers do that
means
makes a big difference,
though.
You
see these lines on the roof.
Yeah, it's 3 to 4 little molded lines that run parallel with the hem. One of the things that our roofers do to help with oil canning is they'll use like a 1/2-inch backer rod and apply that to the back of the panel before it goes down, so it helps create a little bit of a ridge in the middle, almost like a stretch. Obviously, good framing is key.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, those little techniques like that will definitely help. I like metal roofs. They're going to last the longest. They're not the best for insurance. Once they get dented by hail, it's cosmetic. You're not usually going to see a roof failure. So if you have roofs, metal roof that's, you know, on battens and they're back vented underneath the metal before the sheathing, they are very susceptible to the hail that we get here in Central Texas. And if insurance comes out, unless you specifically pay for cosmetic replacement versus actual roofing failure, insurance isn't going to cover stuff like that. Shingles, architectural, 3D, those are probably the most common. You don't see a lot of people using a 3-tab shingle anymore because of the wind issues that you would get on a 3-tab. Some people still like them, though. We've had people ask, you know, we just want a 3-tab roof. And say, no, please don't. And then there's some other new technology out for flat roofs. IB Roofing Systems has a PVC roof that we spec over TPO now.
What?
It's awesome. We did it on
to bring up flat roofs.
Yeah, we did it on a recent build.
So what's it called?
It's a PVC membrane instead of a TPO membrane.
What happens in a fire with that?
Does
it just melt?
That's a good question. I think it depends on how hot it gets, but I'm pretty sure it's from a fire rating, it's probably the same as a TPO roof. I haven't looked into that. The difference with it versus a TPO roof is, you know, a TPO roof is a 25 to 30 year roof. This is considered a 50 to 75 year roof.
Okay.
And it's only anywhere from an 8 to 15% difference in cost for the material. Goes on the same. It's rolled out the same. Great product. We just finished one.
Does it come in different colors?
Yeah, we just did. The one that we just finished was this kind of dark charcoal gray color. And we opted for that in lieu of the metal roof because it was a quarter on 12 pitch roof over huge runs, some of them 70 foot long. And you couldn't see the roof. And we were going to spend all this money on a black metal roof where you can't see anything. And we were looking for ways to VE this project and had some discussions with her roofer and ended up going for this. Saved about $15,000 on the project and looks great. It's detailed really well. So, really, really pleased with that. Other things, techniques folks do, what I mentioned a few minutes ago is they'll back vent these metal roofs to help with some of the thermal issues outside of the envelope. You see a lot of sweating on roofs depending on how the house is insulated, depending on the installation techniques of the roofing material, the underlayment, stuff like that. But you'll see, especially in cold months, you'll see sweating in lines on your roof, in your rafters, because your heat transfer that comes from the inside, you'll see all that frost start to melt in certain spots, but parts of it will stay still frosted over. So what a lot of folks have been doing, what a few folks have been doing is putting these metal roofs on battens and almost like a rain screen. Mm-hmm. So once you have, because metal's very conductive, right? Thermally, mm-hmm. electrically, so on and so forth. You create this air gap just like you would on siding. Okay. And it allows that moisture to not get entrapped between the metal and the roofing underlayment and cause, I don't know if it's going to ever actually mold. I've never pulled a metal roof off, to be honest with you. We haven't had to. But you could imagine that there would be entrapment between the panels and the underlayment just from thermal properties and weather change, and the vast weather change that we get within a 24-hour period here can probably cause stuff like that. So, and that does help with sound dampening too. The more mm-hmm. air you have between something, mm-hmm. the more room there is for sound to reverberate in that gap and dissipate. Mm-hmm. So
slow down. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Cool.
But yeah, no clay tile roofs. I've never done one. We've torn a lot off and we've repaired
some.
That's
a new challenge.
I don't know. I hate clay tile.
Why?
Oh, no, I love
it. It's so just pretty. Tuscan. Reminds me of 2008 architecture.
It's 1920s okay, Beverly I Hills. Totally get that.
Yeah.
That was not a good period.
No, that was a bad period.
Everything looked like Olive Garden.
Yeah.
I think it can be done and detailed properly, though. I think there's some really cool ways to detail it.
There's not just the barrel roof. There's the flat. There's all mm-hmm. kinds of.
There's a whole different level of waterproofing that goes on below that, though.
Mm-hmm.
So. Something that we'd definitely like to do, I think.
Brad has a very big brain. You've had a lot. You've lived 3 or 4 lives for being so young. You know so many things.
Still learning. I don't know what I don't know yet. Yes. So trying
he
to figure it all out.
He has a lot of file folders in his head.
I'm so impressed.
The weird thing is they're all in my head.
Yes.
I don't have books in the office to turn around and pull out. It's like, all right, we'll just figure it out. If I break it, we'll fix it.
I'm very impressed.
So it's fun. That's the fun part of it. It's kind of I think it's a risk versus reward thing, right? If I can think hard enough to figure it out and it works, then that's rewarding. Woo-hoo. And if we mess it up, screw it, we'll fix it. And now we know for next time.
So, cool. Well, thank you so much for being
thank
here
you.
Again.
Always appreciate it. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Design Oracles. And if you like the show or learned something new, please give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you are listening on. Follow us on Instagram at Design Oracles, and you can also find more information at our website, designoracles.com.